Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Representative Hillstrom, we have your bill, but we're going to, because we don't have a quorum, we will just hear testimony on your bill at this point, and once people come in, you counting better than we are, Representative Biskins?
Just counting.
She's, Ms. Lacombe has assured me we need 9.2 members?
9.2.
9.5. So when the half member comes in, we'll, so we'll hear testimony on your bill, and I understand you have another bill at another committee, then we'll take it up again when we have a quorum, and we'll move your bill with the understanding that we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, members, we're on House File 1307. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1307 is an appropriation for local units of government to hire peace officers and to pay for overtime. This is $2.5 million in for fiscal year 08 and $2.5 million for fiscal year ending in 09. With me is the police chief, the City of Brooklyn Center, and also Bill Gillespie from MPPOA. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to them.
Good morning. As a law enforcement administrator,
would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Okay. Scott Bechtold, Chief of Police for the City of Brooklyn Center.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right. As a police administrator, my mission is simple. It's to protect and serve in a manner that preserves the public trust. Therefore, I'm sworn to protect the citizens of my community from all types of crime, especially violent crime. All too often, I've witnessed the devastation that violent crime brings to my community and the lasting and often irreparable harm suffered by the victims and their families. That is why the recent rise in the violent crime rates in the state of Minnesota is such a cause for concern. For the past 10 years, law enforcement agencies throughout the United States have made tremendous strides in reducing the level of crime and violence in the United States. This was after a period of rising crime in the early 1990s. The decline in crime was a direct result of federal funds that came out of the 1994 Violent Crime Act and were used to start the Community-Oriented Police Service Program and the Burn Justice Administration Grant Program. Both programs benefited communities across the country by making available funds to support hiring officers, including 1,200 officers in the state of Minnesota, providing funds to state and local governments in controlling and preventing drug abuse, crime and violence, and improving the criminal justice system. In my department, we've used the Justice Assistance Grant, also known as JAG, to fund overtime details for directed patrols to hotspots and emerging crime problems. By the end of 2002, the success was evident. Murder rates nationwide dropped 40%, violent crime fell by 33%, and in the City of Brooklyn Center, our overall Part 1 crime fell by 20%. Today, there again is an increase in crime, especially violent crimes, in certain communities. Once was considered an urban problem has migrated out to suburban and even rural communities. To give you some examples, Hennepin County suburbs, the violent crime rate rose 14.6% in 2005. The largest increases were in robbery and aggravated assault. In Brooklyn Center, we experienced a 30% increase in violent crime over the past 3 years. My neighbor to the north, Brooklyn Park, has experienced a 92% increase in robbery alone in 2005. There's no question that the increase in crime, violence and otherwise, corresponds to the substantial decline in funding for law enforcement from the federal and state government. Federal funding for the COPS program and the Justice Assistance Grants have been cut nearly 90%. Since 9-1-1, the focus has been on terrorism, and we have gone from hometown security to homeland security. On a state level, budget cuts to local government aid have forced some local governments to reduce the number of law enforcement personnel. For example, in the city of Brooklyn Center, we lost two officer positions and were forced to give up our 911 dispatch center. The loss of those two sworn positions has reduced our proactive time from 33% to just below 20%. To explain this further, field patrol studies have shown that when proactive time falls below 30%, a number of things occur which have a negative impact on operations. First of all, we go into a reactive response. All we do is answer calls, 911 calls for service. Response time suffers. Service quality suffers, and officers suffer from burnout. We're not naive to the fact that additional officers alone are not going to solve the problem in its entirety. Too many crimes are committed by undereducated kids who lack the support of a functional family unit, along with a strained social service community, a challenged educational system, and this whole glamorization of the thug-pop mentality. The bottom line, it's a community problem that goes beyond the resources of law enforcement. But additional resources can make an impact to the effectiveness of our agencies. The bill that is being proposed today would not only help with additional cops on the street, but the ability to fund innovative strategies directed at reducing crime, the fear of crime, improving the overall quality of life in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Mr. Gillespie, do you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Gillespie, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We represent 8,500 line police officers across the state of Minnesota. I've known Scott for a long time. That's as focused, as on point as I've ever heard. That's his, pretty much what he said is my testimony. There are two aspects of this that I would like to point out. One, nothing suppresses crime like a cop in a tin can riding through the neighborhood. Studies have shown that. When you have fewer of them, then bad people don't feel like they have to hide in the shadows. Kids go in to watch TV. Mischief makers end up in bars where they belong, doing mischief. So when you reduce the number of police officers actively patrolling the streets, the opportunities for crime, and it comes under a theory of called broken windows, and I won't go into that. The committee have heard it way too many times. But fewer cops mean more broken windows, which means more disrespect for law and order. So this bill, which I hardly support, and our association is on record as supporting, would go a long way for all the law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota to have an ability to be, through grant process, be able to add additional police officers for the short term. The second point, the thing I'd like to point out to you is the reason that's important is it takes 12 to 18 months to put a police officer on the street. You just can't reach in the closet and take out a cop or go down to Kmart and get one. It's an extensive process of background review and training that you have to go through in order to actually see an FTE on the street in a tin can riding around. So in a short-term process, overtime is the best option that you have. It's not an option that I normally would support because it reduces the number of reliance upon full-time police officers, which I still think is the optimal situation. But when you don't have any and you need to get some, this is the best way to go about providing additional police services. And with that, I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Representative Hillstrom, you want to, we have a quorum now. Do you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1307 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. So, Representative Hillstrom, how many police officers or Mr. Gillespie would, well, let me try to divide it up. And are you, are we saying that we are going to allot a certain amount of officers to be hired, or is this primarily for overtime? I don't know who wants to take that.
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because this is only a two-year situation, the number of officers that would be hired to become full-time would kind of depend on the community and their willingness to fund them ongoing. That is, of course, our preference, but ultimately in these high crime rate areas, we do just want additional officers. And so it would be up to the community to then apply for these grants. And so hopefully they would end up in long-term police officers or full-time police officers, but to start it would be, I would bet, part-time officers or overtime officers, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's about $75,000 to put an officer on the street. That's the initial cost. If you wanted to do the math and equate that $2.5 million each year, you could figure out what that would be, but that would be a one-time purchase of that officer, and the continuing tails that Representative Hillstrom talks about is incurred. This figure is pretty much a guess, and it's a good figure, but I don't know that anybody knows exactly what that figure would be necessary, but this is certainly a good guess.
And Representative Hillstrom, just to clarify now this, on line 110, or 19, 110, it says the appropriation of this paragraph are added to the department's base budgets, the department's base budget. And then on line 114 and 115, it says that the appropriations in this paragraph are one-time appropriations.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was actually drafted by the Senate, and so we would probably need to make a decision on which one we wanted to do. I would love for this to be added to the department's base for long term. I don't know that that will be within our budget. And so, again, our intent was that these appropriations would be one-time appropriations.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom, we have a couple of questions. I don't know if you want to propose an amendment. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a few questions, but the first was indeed the question that you just raised about base budget versus one time and a seeming conflict in the testimony that we'll have to clear up that before we move along. But I do notice the bill is also drafted in such a way that there can be no mixing of the $2, all right, that there's $5 million set aside for new hires and then another $5 million set aside for overtime pay. And there is no provision to allow the mixing of those dollars. And so I do have a question about what is the typical overtime rate of pay, and, you know, is it feasible to pay overtime, or is it better to look for new officers? And then the final question I have deals with just what is the status of licensed officers in the state of Minnesota? I know my brother is now an officer in the New Prague, city of New Prague, and I think there was, for their one full-time opening, they had about 20 applicants. So I'm wondering, you know, is there a shortage or... it seemed to him while he was job hunting that there was no shortage and it was a pretty competitive field. So if I could have answers to those.
Mr. Gillespie, there's two questions there about overtime and...
Mr. Chair, first if I could clarify.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. I guess in reading the bill, it is early. The first part is for grants for new hires, and that is to be ongoing. The second part is for overtime, which is a one-time appropriation. So I apologize for my misspeaking earlier, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I need you to
move. Mr. Gillespie, do you want to respond to Representative Biskin's questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Biskins, there is, in fact, always a need for qualified applicants. And that's a competitive testing process. There are always more people in the pipeline than there are for job applications. Whether or not the majority of them want to work in Fountain City and they want to work in Minneapolis or St. Paul or Brooklyn Center is a matter of personal choice as far as the officers' candidates go. They want action. They want to go to the Twin Cities. If they want to hunt waterfowl, they want to go to New Prague. And it's simply the hiring decision process is unaffected by anything that the system does. Does that help?
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Gillespie, I suppose I could go right to the chief and ask, because obviously Craig didn't have a shortage of candidates. And these, you know, candidates, of course, meet all the licensing qualifications. Now, the question might be, are we giving license to, you know, follow up on your statement, are we giving license to people who should not get licenses, all right? You know, and that's a different question, I guess. But to the chief, when you have an opening, do you have a shortage of applicants for your openings?
Chief Bechtel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, usually we go through a recruiting process once a year, and we will get about 100 people applying for the one job each year. And we will find several qualified candidates out of that pool of 100.
Representative Zellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is probably Mr. Gillespie or the chief. the ongoing appropriation, new officers, that's, I agree with you. My concern is for the rank and file. And probably for the chief more than anything, what is this doing for morale and for, you know, just the sheer wear and tear on officers? My concern, no offense to, you know, to the, some of the city council members or some of the folks that are, you know, the bureaucrats, the ones that sit in chairs, but I'm more concerned about the guys and men and women in the tin cans. What is the overtime going to do for not only morale, but just physical wear and tear on them in the field?
Chief Bechtel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, that's a very good question. As far as currently, as I stated before, we are down to an 18% proactive rate, where essentially it's put our officers going from call to call to call. They're getting wore down. As far as overtime, if I don't get any full-time support, the overtime is a mute issue because I can't even get the officers to sign up for overtime the way it is right now. That's my department. Other departments probably are in a better position to fill overtime initiatives centered around hotspot patrol, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gillespie, maybe from a statewide.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, normally I would not be all that supportive of this concept simply because of burnout, I guess, is as good a word as any, but you do have a we all went to the same staff command school. There's a coefficient of efficiency that's involved with patrol functions, and as you spend time and resources and manpower, which is all that you have to work with, your efficiency begins to drop off because people get tired. It's also an officer safety issue because people get lax and they make silly mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
For a short time process, I support this because there is no other answer for the next 18 months to 2 years while they put police officers in these positions to begin to build up the law enforcement agencies that were pretty much reduced by some decisions not of their own making. Administrators and city council people had to make some decisions. How does that affect law enforcement officers, men and women of law enforcement? Well, everything goes downhill, as you know, and this probably will all be very tiresome in the end. And Chief Bechtel is correct. It's hard in some locations to get people to work additional overtime. They've been working overtime, and cities and counties have gone into their reserves in order to pay for that or raised property taxes in order to be able to pay for that. But if you have a Brookdale and you have a Mega Mall, or if you have a Rosedale and your officers are already assigned out there to work overtime, that's a specific thing. But not everybody is lucky to have a Brookdale or a Mega Mall that stops up overtime needs. So I think for most of the agencies and for most of the officers for a short time period, this is an excellent answer. And yes, they'll get tired, and hopefully there will not be any pejorative outcome from that.
Representative Liebling, and then Haas, and then I'd like to move on to the next bill, unless we have more Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pilstrom, I know before I came in that you might have discussed this, and I apologize for that. But I understand that that you had said earlier that this is a grant process and that these grants could be given out throughout the state. But I'm just wondering, is there already a process in place within the department for deciding who would get these grants and whether there are particular criteria in place for getting a grant? Just wondering if, you know, how that process is going to work for getting this out to various locations.
Yes,
Chairman, Representative Liebling, there's already in existence in the Department of Public Safety a COPS program. So it's a mini COPS program, and the commissioner has a grant process by which he can award grants to local units of government for the for this very purpose. And they just, in fact, there's a bill in, I think it was offered yesterday that wisely throws me off the commission that generates the, and advises the commissioner on these matters. And I'm not alone, the chiefs, the sheriffs, we all get thrown off. So. We don't know why we displeased this representative, but apparently we have.
Representative Haas.
My concern was for the length of the grants, but if there's a program already set up, I'm assuming that it works properly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haas. Representative Viskins, you got it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and this could either be to Representative Hillstrom or maybe even better, Mr. Carter. The question just simply is, I noticed that this does go into the current COPS program. How much more is this? What percentage? I mean, is this a 1% increase to the current COPS program? Is this a 50% increase? How significant is this $10 million more for the COPS program?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, to my understanding, there is no base funding for this program. I think it was funded like either in 96, and I know 99 for, and I think at 99 it was at one time $500,000 appropriation. So right now there is no base funding for it.
Representative Biskins.
What, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter, is there federal funds though for this program?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, I know there were federal funds, but I do not know the current funding for that. I know the federal funds have been, going down drastically over the last couple of years.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure that as you put your bill together, all right, you'll have the answer to that for us, obviously. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gillespie, Chief Bechtel, for your testimony. Representative Hillstrom, we will lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
May I have a motion from someone to approve the minutes of February 14th, 15th, and 21st?
Yes.
Representative Zellers has moved the minutes of February 14th, 15th, 21st, and February 21st. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails. The next bill on the agenda is House File 687. Representative Ward, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Representative Ward, you have the 0147, the 147 amendment, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Then I will first.
That amendment.
I will first move House File 687, and then I will move the amendment 147 to get the bill in the order that the author desires. Are there any questions or discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, Representative Ward, welcome to the committee. You can present your bill and your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, with me today is Buck McAlpin, O.J. Doyle, and two survivors of AED defibrillators, Gene Johnson and Ray Eiler. And We're here to talk about House File 687, which is a pretty basic bill about defibrillators. And I just want to start by asking you members a question. you know, when you call 911, you have an emergency at your home, who is most likely in outstate Minnesota, anyhow in rural Minnesota, to respond to that? You don't have to raise your hand. Just think of that in your mind. And in my area, the most likely it is the law enforcement folks are the first ones that is an emergency 911 call. And if it's somebody that's in cardiac arrest or somebody that's having some difficulty with their heart, if they have a defibrillator, they save lives, and we'll hear that from some people that are survivors. My own father has had 4 heart attacks, who needed to be defibbed back twice and is alive because of that. We just received in the House emails yesterday from Nick DeRuyo, that defibrillators are now in the state office building. They're around here. And why are they around here? They're around here because they save lives. And so the purpose of this bill is just that, is to make defibrillators more available, especially in outstate Minnesota. In Metro, they have many defibrillators, and the testifiers can talk to that, but they have defibrillators available to law enforcement, to the people that respond to those emergencies already. So this bill is to try to make defibrillators available through a grant program to all law enforcement vehicles outstate Minnesota. With that, I will turn over to our testifiers.
Thank you, everyone. Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McKelp, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We support House File 687 and work with Representative Ward on the amendment and to discuss some of the issues about moving out with some more auto defibs. I've been a paramedic over 20 years and been to numerous cardiac arrest calls. We carry some very sophisticated equipment in our ambulances. But, of course, unless your cardiac arrest right in front of us in the ambulance response times are usually longer than the squad cars. They're out on the street. They're there, especially in rural Minnesota. We notice our ambulance volumes have just skyrocketed close to 500,000 a year throughout the state. So the demand on EMS gets quite heavy. When these type of runs come in, even though they're few and far between, the cardiac arrest is a very short window. The sooner the better. You know, after 4 or 5 minutes, you start to decrease your survivability with cardiac arrest. There's certain parts of the state, Representative Owen, up in our northwest area, where the ambulances may have 45 minutes to get to the scene with long response times, where the squad car may be 4 or 5 blocks away. We also talked in the amendment about our 8 regional EMS programs. We've got a very nice network from the metro all the way throughout the state that these folks do coordinate currently with law enforcement, sheriff's agencies, hospitals, and need to look at where we have them and where we need to have defibs in the future. So we asked Representative Ward to include that, to evaluate and bring a report back in a few years to talk about where we have defibs, where we need to move forward with defibs. So anything the committee could do to see fit to help with this, we do know in rural Minnesota there is still a shortage in some counties that can't afford to buy defibrillators in small community law enforcement agencies.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ward, I really support this concept a lot. And in my own area in Rochester, I think now all the squad cars have this, and it's been really, really successful. So I think it's a great concept. I do have a question, though, on your amendment about this advisory committee. And, you know, I understand that the intention is to try to be fair and get the grants out around the state. But I just wonder if you would speak for a minute about how you've decided to set up this this advisory committee. I don't know if this bill would go to another committee from here. I know that sometimes state government GovOps looks at different commissions that are set up and stuff. I don't know if this would qualify for that.
I'm not sure that it would. We're not creating a task force, but we can...
Yeah.
We'll have to check into it. If it does need to go to government operations, okay. We will make that referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to create more stops for Representative Ward's bill, but I just wonder if you could talk for a minute about why you decided to put all these different organizations in here, because it seems to me that the real issue that you want to make sure that you're fair about is more the geographic issue and the need issue. And I'm just kind of wondering, it just looks kind of cumbersome to me that you have all these different organizations here and not necessarily any geographic balance.
Representative Ward, Mr. Carger is going to go check to see if this will cause a step to the Government Operations Committee.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, can I just respond briefly to that? I asked O.J. Doyle and Buck McKelpin to organize this committee, or to what who should be on that committee. I'm going to ask O.J. to respond to that, please.
Mr. Doyle, do you want to introduce yourself to the record, please?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is O.J. Doyle. I'm a lobbyist for a number of emergency medical services organizations and also a former paramedic. I've been involved in all the AED legislation. There's been four of them over the past 15 years, and that's kind of, I guess, why I'm involved in this one. And one of the things that we've experienced is there's no system in Minnesota to track defibrillators once they're purchased. We know they're out there, but we don't know where they are specifically. And what the intent was is to give kind of a framework to this so that they are put in the most appropriate place and then tracked after that. As far as the advisory committee, the commissioner of public safety doesn't work in the healthcare area, and we just figured that, you know, it would be good to have some input from like the Heart Association, the Ambulance Association, which do have considerable knowledge of AEDs and these things, and then also the law enforcement, just to get some input from them, because we in the EMS industry don't know much about law enforcement, so we thought it'd be a good mix.
And Representative Ward, so we don't have a dollar amount, you have a blank appropriation. Do you have an idea of what this might cost, or who's working with you to craft a number?
Mr. Chair, members, good question. Thank you for that. We'll take millions of dollars. but realistically, we talked about $100,000 this year, $100,000 next year, and so $200,000 in the biennium. That would get us about, and the figures are at, run around $1,000 each. They're somewhat competitive pricing at this point. We may be able to get them a little cheaper than that, than $1,000 per unit. So we were trying to get around 200 units, somewhere between 150 and 200 units around the state of Minnesota, which would be approximately $200,000 for the biennium.
Mr. Doyle, is that numbers? I mean, how do you do an analysis of the need here?
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. Probably as much of an educated guess as anything else, and that is because we do not have a mechanism, as I was saying before, for tracking these and establishing the need. So we thought if we had that amount of money, pretty positive that there's at least 200 squad cars in rural Minnesota that would need these. And then the last paragraph of the amendment, that sets up the study requirements, so for future needs they can be determined, and we can have a very nice system for knowing where these are, which also if they're not working, so the people who have them know who to contact to replace a battery or a cracked case or something like that. There's no mechanism right now to do that, and so we feel that $200,000 is probably an appropriate amount.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in a former life, I was a volunteer fireman in the city of Jordan, and we had charitable gaming in the fire department, and we found that a very appropriate expenditure from charitable gaming funds. In fact, I recall us purchasing for the schools, for the police officers, and for the fire department, and I'm wondering, you know, if that's out there and why we wouldn't be looking at that venue for getting this very important equipment into squad cars, and if it isn't there. My other point, Mr. Chairman, I was practicing my math again, and believe it or not, Mr. Chairman, it's surprisingly close in this committee, the number of metro versus outstate members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zeller.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Probably doesn't surprise that Representative Biskins and I were thinking along the same lines. For Representative Ward, there's a number of foundations out there that are also providing these happens that a good friend of mine runs one up your neck of the woods, a little bit further to the west. You know, for purchasing power, have you looked at partnerships with that? You know, if it's maybe you know, the Dakota Medical Foundation can't give you, they give them away, but they can't give you 5 or 10, but use their buying power as a way. And maybe, I don't know if Mr. Carter can help me, that may be maybe illegal or something, but using that buying power to get a reduced rate, to Mr. Doyle's comment, I like the idea of a network, so that I know some of them are in disrepair, and you know, if you have one in your school, who's watching it, and then where do you know where to send it back to for a new battery repair?
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to refer that question about buying power and cooperative efforts to Mr. Doyle and Mr. McAlpin, who have successfully done that within the State Highway Patrol. So, and we've also talked about and looked at that same model. So if we could do that, please.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, the problem with that is, with the group buying approach, is that, and you'll notice in the amendment, it says that the law enforcement people receive these should coordinate with their local ambulance provider. There's 4 or 5 manufacturers of defibrillators, and not all ambulance services use the same one. So you get into a position of, you do group buying, then, you know, you've got a Phillips in the squad car, and you've got a physio control in the ambulance, and the patches aren't interchangeable, things like that. So,
Representative Olin.
Just a comment, and then I would like to make an amendment. The comment is, the charitable gambling was used in Pennington County for some, but I don't know that it's realistic for all of them. The amendment I would like to make is, I'm really uncomfortable with a blank space, so I'd like to move it this time to put the sum of $200,000 in as a number, but not make it over 2 years, just leave it. $200,000 is appropriate, paid it, so it's one word.
All right, members, so on line 14, you are going to, Representative Olin moves to insert $200,000. Did you want that over the biennium, the $100,000?
I just didn't want to change the whole function, so I just said $200,000 since he's got in 1 year, like I just left it in the 1 year. And it's actually 1.7.
1.7. And you want to amend it to $200,000 appropriated for the fiscal year ending in June 30th, 2008.
That's correct.
Representative Ward, do you have a comment on Representative Olin's amendment?
I'm agreeable with that, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Olin.
All right, does everyone understand the amendment? Any discussion? Representative Eastland.
I'm fine with the amendment. I think since the bill is only going to be laid over, we're not actually going to vote to pass the bill. I mean, the blank appropriation is really, and a number are actually irrelevant, because when we put together the omnibus bill, we'll put the number in that we want to put in there if we want to include it. So, I mean, I'm not sure the amendment is necessary, but...
Any further discussion?
$50,000, if that's what they can get.
Mr. Chairman, just a Representative Dallas.
Do we still have the amendment before us? Because then wouldn't the amendment actually be going in line 1.4? I think you're right the first time.
Yes.
So if we adopted the amendment, then we said it's not 1.7, it's 1.4.
Yeah, procedurally, I believe that's correct. I forgot about that.
It's semantics, Mr. Chairman. It's just...
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead. You were right the first time, though, so I just want to make sure.
Representative Olin moves
on page 1, line, page 1-4 of the amendment, line to insert $200,000. And I think that's, we should have amended the amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment prevails. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, do we have a report from Mr. Carger about the advisory committee?
Mr. Carger, do you want to... If this bill is in the omnibus bill, apparently we don't... It does not need to travel to the government operations. If it travels on its own, it would. Is that Mr. Carger?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is correct. If it goes on its own, it would be referred to government ops. However, if it's part of the omnibus bill, we simply have to notify the committee of government ops. So that's usually done by a letter that it's included.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
The question before us then is whether we should leave on line 11 the word advisory committee, or if we should turn the advisory committee into a working group.
I would defer to the author, Representative Ward. What do you think about that?
That's fine, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I move that on line 11 we create a working group.
Representative.
The commissioner shall create a working group. Then he doesn't have to report to anybody.
Representative Murphy moves to amend line 11. Striking advisory committee and inserting the words working group. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Are there any other amendments to Representative Ward's bill? Representative Lilly, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward. I'm just trying to get my arms around this. So, you know, I'm in Ramsey County, for example, and so I think these things are fantastic, but why just outstate? I still can't get my arms around that. I see you got a couple people with you from Hennepin County, and you know they're also in the exempted counties. And yeah, we can raise them, and we can get stuff sometimes from charitable things. But really, I mean, this shouldn't it be in every law enforcement vehicle, you know, throughout the whole state of Minnesota? I mean, these machines are so impressive. And yes, in every community, our communities as well, the first responders often are the police and can get there on so many things so much faster. In our city, we have ambulance in our fire station. It's Stillwater, it's Lakeview Hospital, and they, you know, we contract with them, and they, I mean, they respond very quickly. But even still, in a small city like North St. Paul, the police are on the scene so much faster. So really, I mean, shouldn't these things be in every vehicle throughout the state? I know your intentions, I think, are good, but I just don't understand why your people should be treated different than like my people. So that's kind of, could you answer that question, please?
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, thank you for the question. It's a good question, and I'm going to have answer that question, please.
Representative McDowell.
We talked about that quite a bit. Where the big need is right now is rural Minnesota. Mr. Eilers called all the 87 counties and some law enforcement agencies and checked where the equipment was. And what we find in the metro area is they're very built out. The squad cars have them. The first responder trucks have them. In Ramsey and Hennepin County, during the day, there's over 120 ambulances on duty. For an area the size of maybe the Northwest EMS area with four ambulances, of course, the geographic population's different. That was the main reason we wanted the study in here, is to come back and have the Metro Region EMS program come back to the commissioner and say, we need 40 of them in the metro area. Part of the work OJ did last year with the Mittewakan tribe was to purchase 499 defibrillators to build out the whole state patrol. That program should be done here by June of this year. So we find the metro is very saturated with defibrillators. When the outstate small counties, Lincoln County, Pine County, folks like that, will say they can't afford to upgrade their squad cars, then we'd like them to buy a $1,000, $1,500 defibrillator.
We'd just like to figure out a way to get the outstate done first and then move back to the metro.
Representative Murphy has a question, and then I'd like to move on if unless we have any other burning questions about the bill. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, in previous budget for proposals and previous appropriations from this committee, I believe we funded some from various places at various times, going back as far as maybe 10 years. Mr. Carter could tell me if I'm wrong, but...
Do you have a recollection of this, Mr. Carter? We can get this information as we... Mr. Doyle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I've had the opportunity, the privilege to work on all the AED bills over the past 15 years, and there was, prior to this one, last session, there was the appropriations for the State Patrol. Before that, there was a grant program for all the volunteer ambulances in the state to get them, and prior to that, there was a smaller, about 15 years ago, I think there was a, in fact, I think you were involved with it, it was a first responder matching grant program to distribute these also, so there's been a pretty long record of working with law enforcement to provide these.
And Representative Murphy. $50,000 or $60,000 at one point in time. And, of course, inflation has happened since.
Is there any other discussion? Then, Representative Ward, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Lee, the question wasn't answered, but don't you believe that those belong in every law enforcement vehicle? And we do. They save lives, and we do, and this is a start. And I want to recognize two survivors of AED usage. They're not going to get an opportunity to testify, but they're here, they're in their orange shirts, and they've had a second chance at life. Before the testimony, before the committee meeting today, they both said to me, we're here because we got a second chance at life, and that's the reality right behind us. I'd like to recognize Ray Eiler and Gene Johnson.
But, Thank you for coming.
Can I hold enough to make a statement here, please?
Yes, please. Anyone you want to give them a seat there? We'll just take maybe a minute or two for if you would like to.
When you become a survivor.
Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
My name is Ray Eiler, and I am a survivor. I'm from Little Canada. I'm the guy that called all 87 counties. And I found all kinds of attitude among sheriffs. I talked to all sheriffs or their chief deputies. And I'd like to recommend with this bill that, you can't just place something and say it's going to be okay forever. You almost have to inspect. And I know it's an expense to hire new inspectors. I know it's a pain in the neck to do it. But we have in place in Minnesota inspectors for all of our health, all of our rest homes, all of our nursing homes. They make unannounced visits to every home in Minnesota. And they spend 2 or 3 days in some, and spend a day in some, and maybe they spend a week or two. And over at Veterans Administration now, we have special crews trying to straighten the thing out. What I'm trying to say here is that as long as you have these inspectors for nursing homes, I think we have nursing homes in just about every county in Minnesota. Why not tack onto their simple responsibilities the need to inspect unannounced the AEDs placed in emergency vehicles or police cars or sheriff's cars? In my calls to the 87 counties, I had one chief deputy tell me, "Yeah," he says, "we got an AED, but it's just like everything else. When you want to use it, the damn battery is dead." This guy was in charge of the AEDs. So you almost have to have somebody making sure that he's doing what he's supposed to do. I want to make one more suggestion, if I may. You have a list of people that you want to be on a committee. The Minnesota Sudden Cardiac Arrest Survivors Network We're not just a bunch of pretty faces. We're not just a bunch of people saying, gee, you had heart attack too? We were instrumental with the Heart Association in getting the AEDs placed on all the state patrol cars. After we did that, we didn't have a project anymore. In the St. Paul paper last year appeared an article concerning a St. Paul caregiver on a cruise in Hawaii. One of the entertainers on the cruise ship collapsed in front of her. Being a caregiver, she recognized heart problems right now. She proceeded to give CPR, and she called for an AED, but there wasn't one. But she saved his life anyway. That prompted us to take on the responsibility of lobbying the United States Congress and Senate to pass a law requiring AEDs on all ships picking up passengers in the United States. That's what we're working on now.
Taylor, we need you to wrap up your testimony. We have another bill up.
Okay. Well, that's all I got to say, but I want to call special attention to these outstate counties, because some of these counties, they only have one or two cars, and they have all kinds of attitudes about AEDs. I spoke to the Sheriff's Department, said we don't want any part of them. That's the guy that's got to be taught a lesson.
Thank you, Mr. Ayler, for your testimony. Representative Ward, we will...
This is some information on the survivors group.
If you want to give it to the page, we'll get that. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Ward. We will lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Next up, Mr. Chair, members.
Next up is Representative Lesh, House File 1311.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee. Do you want to move your bill?
Yes, do you want me to move it first, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1311 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Do you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you for hearing this bill. I wanted to recognize the individuals who are here with me. We have Chief John Harrington, Chief of the St. Paul Police Department, Shirley Johnson Klein, Executive Director of the St. Paul Intervention Project, and Mary Louise Kloss, retired Ramsey County District Court Judge and Chair of ISAIAH's Domestic Violence Task Force. And I wanted to begin by telling committee members a story that I tell a few times, and many of you know that I'm a domestic assault prosecutor in the city of St. Paul. And I haven't, when I first started doing that, I hadn't been doing it for very long, when a person in our office, we have a paralegal who sets up interviews with women who are victims, and all victims, women and men, who are victims of domestic violence. And in this particular case, we had a woman come in, and she had stitches on her forehead. And she walked in, I had read the police reports, and she walked into the room and she said, I know, I walked into a door frame. And I said, oh, okay. Well, then I started flipping through the file and getting to my file, and she knew what I was going to do, and she said again, I walked into a door frame. And she folded her arms and she looked away. And I thought, okay, I'm new at this, what do I do now? And I have the police reports in front of me. And the police reports indicated that her husband of 7 years had taken one of those padded beams on the side of the waterbed and turned it around and smacked her in the head with it and beat her up pretty bad. And I said, you know, here's the deal. I understand, and I understand the situation that you're in. I've got a situation where I've got some police reports that tell a different story. What I need to find out from you is, what do you need out of this situation? What do you and your kids really need? And there was a little bit of back and forth, and I asked her the question again, and she started to cry. And I thought, wow, okay, what do I do now? What kind of situation am I in? And she finally said, I just want to be left alone. I want the guy to leave me alone. And she didn't know how to do that. She didn't know how to get out. Now, what we have here in this bill is a request for a one-time appropriation from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety for $500,000 to be granted to the City of St. Paul to develop and implement an integrated domestic violence response framework. for situations like this. The terms are very specific. The City of St. Paul will focus on developing and implementing a comprehensive and coordinated systemic response for situations like these that takes into account national best practices, quality assurance measurements, and addresses specific cultural challenges. The project then, what we'll do is we'll take it statewide, develop a model for a domestic response framework that can be used throughout the state. And this is the most important part of this bill, or what we're going to do for all parts of the state and all your communities. We recognize that domestic violence has an impact on residents of our state, and it affects public health, public safety, education, human rights, and it has an economic impact, too, with people's jobs. What I wanted to say is that this situation in St. Paul, we're at a unique crossroads in St. Paul. We have an opportunity to do something because of the individuals. We just opened a domestic assault service center in St. Paul, and we're going to be working with the city and county attorney's office as well as the police department to provide a situation where we can take a comprehensive look at all the things we're doing with respect to domestic assault in the city. What this will do is put the City of St. Paul in an excellent position to provide tutelage and instruction to other parts of the state to change their practices so we can have a better approach to domestic assault overall. We will implement system-wide policies and procedures, integrate our systemic response, and measure the positive effect this system can have for stopping domestic violence within our homes. Now, in the past, not too long ago, before I started prosecuting domestic assaults, in a situation like this where this woman came in, we would have dismissed that case. We would have said, if you come in and say, nope, this is what happened, I walked in the door and that's how I got hurt, the prosecutor would have said, I don't have a case. She's going to get up there and sit on the stand and say, this didn't happen. I mean, the jury's going to say, yeah, forget about it, reasonable doubt. But what happened years ago with some leaders in our community, including the people sitting to my left, is we implemented a cultural change. There were some folks who got together and they said, you know what, we need to do something called evidence-based prosecution. We need to change the culture and how we approach domestic violence. And so now I, as a prosecutor, have an opportunity to say, hang on a second, I'm going to look at the police report. I know what the police officer is going to say. I have documented injuries. I can use alternative evidence, a history of the relationship. And this is all because we had individuals working for over 30 years on how we change how we look at domestic assault, which is a very pernicious cycle of violence in our community. So with that, what I'd do is I'd like to defer first to Mary Louise Kloss, who's a retired judge, who can talk a little bit about the bill. Or are we going to speak first? Okay, I do whatever the judge tells me, Mr. Chair.
Members, I think that will hold questions if we can hear from the testimony. Is that all right, Representative Mulroy? Okay. Chief Harrington, you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure. My name is John Harrington. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of St. Paul. And I want to thank Representative Paymark, Chairman of the Committee, and all the members here for hearing this bill. I'm here to testify in very strong support for this bill. The St. Paul Integrated Domestic Violence Response Framework is important on a number of different bases, and I'll give you them very quickly because I know you're pressed for time. Number one, over 30 years of being a cop, I've gone to thousands of domestics. And what I know from being a cop is that cops alone don't solve domestics. It's the worst call we go to, but we did not have a solution for it when we were doing this or trying to do this by ourselves. What has worked in St. Paul is a collaborative approach. And what this bill does is it brings together resources for a great collaborative partnership between several governmental and community partners, which include the St. Paul Police Department, the Family Violence Unit, St. Paul Intervention, the Ramsey County Courts, St. Paul City Attorney, and a host of other community organizations who all feel very passionate about this crime. I feel very passionate about this crime, and probably more so in the last few years than even I did when I started on the job. It was a scary call when I first came on the job as a brand new baby cop. But let me tell you, in 2004, when I took over the department, and I'm looking over the landscape of what is going on in St. Paul, I was absolutely horrified to find out that in my city, in that year, we had 15,000 cases of domestic violence. That's 15000. That's 350 cases a week. That's 40 to 50 cases a day. And really, to say there are cases is a misnomer. What that really amounts to is two women, two moms, two daughters, two sisters being battered every hour of every day, of every week, of every month in the year in St. Paul. These are not cases. These are real people whose lives are made absolutely untenable by domestic violence. To put a different framework on it, 15,000 cases is the equivalent of $562,000 in police resources. It is the equivalent of having 8 full-time cops doing nothing but just responding to domestic violence cases. And that's assuming that you only send one cop per case, and we don't just send one cop on a domestic violence call. So that in reality, it's probably far in excess of $1 million in police resources just in St. Paul to just address domestic violence. If you think about domestic violence in terms of a crime problem, and we spend lots of time looking at crime problems, when I look at it, it is the most frequent violent crime committed in the city of St. Paul. You add up all my murders, all my rapes, all my robberies, all my aggravated assaults, all my gunpoint incidents, and you will barely scratch the surface in comparison to the number of domestic violence cases that a city my size goes to. And let me tell you, St. Paul is not alone in having a domestic violence problem. It is a statewide problem. This partnership that we've already begun has already shown great results. One of the things that the partnership has already begun to produce is an audit. An audit that looked at what is the system currently doing about domestic violence. And the results of the audit have already been very enlightening and very helpful. For example, we learned from our audit already that our 911 operators were not asking questions about history of violence, OFPs, or weapons at the call. We as a profession, the 911 operators, the cops that respond, the advocates that have to show up afterwards, the prosecutors that have to handle the cases, the judges that see them at the end of the line, have to know what the lethality quotient is of these cases. It's incredibly important to the safety of the victims, and it's just as important to the safety of the officers who are responding to those cases. That's long ago I had a case. We had a case over a 200 block of Jinx. A couple of my squads get called, sent on a domestic. Woman screaming. It's a Hmong woman. They roll up on the call, and this woman comes running out of the house screaming at them in Hmong. The officers are walking up to the house to try and figure out, okay, we're going to go in and find the husband and figure out what's going on. I was blessed that day because Officer Nia Kong decided to roll up as a backup officer to them. What Nia heard in Hmong was not just a woman screaming in Hmong. What he heard was gun, repeated over and over again. The officers took a different approach immediately. They take a tactical approach to the house, and as they approach the front door, hiding behind the front door was the husband with a loaded gun in his hand. When he sees the cops coming up, and he's not going to be able to take my cops out as they walk in the door. And I really do believe he was prepared to take my cops out. He had already committed one murder that morning. His plan was to kill his wife and to kill the 6 children that were in the house at the same time. He ran to the back of the house, and he killed himself instead. I'm quite confident that if we had not had the luck of a day on our side, I'd have ended up with at least 2 cops injured. I might have ended up with a wife and 6 kids also killed. It is important for us to do a much better job, and the audits and the information are going to make our officers safer in that regard. I want you to keep in mind that statewide, in the last 2 years, 46 women have died because of domestic violence. And 16 children have died because of domestic violence. I'm recently haunted by the picture of a baby, 18 months old, named Destiny, who was beaten to death down on West 7th Street. She is the result of domestic violence gone badly awry. Finally, in closing, I want you to know that this is not just about St. Paul, although I am absolutely confident it will make St. Paul a safer city. But just as a decade ago, the research from Duluth on how we should handle domestic violence in terms of making arrests rather than simply advising on it became a statewide model which has dramatically improved our functioning with domestic violence. The information that would be gathered from this partnership, from this framework, is information that would be available statewide. We would be able to teach what we know and give best practices that would not only make the victim safer, but officers safer, and save us time, money, and the long-term tragedy that domestic violence gives us.
Thank you for your testimony, Chief Harrington. Who's next? Ms. Klein, you want to introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Shelley Johnson Klein, and I'm the director of the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, and I want to thank all of you for inviting us here today to speak about this bill. Chief Harrington framed the issue very well, and he framed it that of what is going across the entire state. As a battered woman's program, I know resources are scarce, but every sister program I have talked to across the state of Minnesota says, yes, please create this model. I've worked in this battered women's movement for over 25 years. I remember women that I have sat up in the shelters and talked to throughout the night about how their lives were going to be because they didn't have to live in fear anymore, and I've gone to their funerals 2 months later. I've held the hands of women who have had to go in and identify the bodies of their children who have been murdered. And I sit up at night and I think no one entity that response to domestic violence could have stopped these tragedies. But I believe that all of us working together, sharing our expertise, and going forward as a unified force will make a difference. We will save lives.
Thank you for your testimony. Judge Klass?
If you can be brief, we have four members who have questions of Representative Lash.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank the committee for allowing us to speak. I'm Mary Louise Kloss. I'm a retired Ramsey County District Court judge. I'm chair of Isaiah's Domestic Violence Task Force, and I've, since 1988 when it was created, I've been a member of the Supreme Court Gender Fairness Implementation Committee. You may well say, why St. Paul? Why now? Chief Harrington has talked about the fact that St. Paul is presently in the midst of an audit which has some preliminary recommendations. The members of the agencies involved in responding to domestic violence representatives of those agencies have formed the teams together with community advocacy, battered women's advocacy programs, and ISAIAH. We've looked at the system and the enthusiasm of the members of the team that did the work and the enthusiasm of the agency heads when they were presented in December with the preliminary recommendations tells me that St. Paul is ready to go ahead and produce this blueprint, which can be adapted, changed, formed by every jurisdiction within the state of Minnesota. It's not Mary Lou Kloss or Chief Harrington or Shelley Johnson Klein coming to your community and saying, this is how you should do it. This is a blueprint which will have training curricula, training modules, standard operating procedures, interagency collaborative agreements. It will be a framework which each of your communities can adapt and use to keep women and children safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Klass. We have four members who have questions. Representative Moore is first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know if it's to Representative Lesher or one of you. I think this is a good idea if we establish something that will work around the whole state. I know when Cy Tao had a bill here on the Asian gangs, he reworked it and made it so that it was effective for everybody in the state, and that's what I want to do. And I know that one of my big issues here is having dealt a little with victims of this, there's a huge difference in the different cultures. And I know that St. Paul has African American, Hmong, and Hispanic. I'm concerned that what is the outreach to, for instance, Somali, Liberian, and others that aren't in St. Paul in very large number. Even Lao are not very much in St. Paul. They're in a lot of other parts of Minnesota. I think Cambodian are mainly elsewhere. And so what my concern is, how do you intend to, first of all, outreach to the groups in St. Paul and then to the other groups? Because I think that any good, effective program is going to have to take into those very large cultural differences on this issue.
Ms. Klein?
What we have done in looking at the budget for this program, the preliminary budget, is most of the actual work going into it from St. Paul is going to be in kind. We're all going to donate our time to make this happen. A bulk of the budget is to have community-based liaisons that represent the different communities that you were talking about throughout Minnesota, and to go out, bring what we're doing to them, bring their input back to us throughout the entire process to make sure that those voices are integrated each step of the way, or it won't work. I entirely agree with you, and that's been built in. That's a large part of the budget.
And if I could just add in,
Barrington.
In our current project, we have a group with MAS, the Muslim American Society, which is addressing issues with Oromo, Somali, Eritrean, and Ethiopian individuals from East African communities in terms of domestic violence. We also have an ongoing partnership with both Hmong American Partnership, the 18 Clan Council, and UConn, which is the Cambodian group. Hispanics with Casa Zaranda. We really, St. Paul, because our city is now well over 45% people of color with about 92 different cultures represented in the city, we really are very much a microcosm of the state of Minnesota in terms of the different populations that come through and live and work and support this city. So I think we are really in a very ideal position to be able to meet that need of culturally specific and culturally relevant processes that will work not just for St. Paul's culture, but for cultures all over the state of Minnesota.
Representative Cornish.
Real quickly, Mr. Chairman. You didn't have to sell us. I mean, you did a good job of it, but we're sure aware of the domestic abuse and the need for the prevention of it from a lot of stories. But the thing that concerns me about the bill is Representative Lesch, if you would look at it after it gets laid over today, I'm worried about its application statewide, because up in Roseau or Duluth or Grand Marais, not only the response times, but the resources they have and the way they respond is so different. And if it's going to be a statewide approach, I thought it would be a good idea to start out statewide, give it to DPS or one of their justice programs or something, and approach it statewide right away rather than develop a policy down here that might not apply somewhere else and take the statewide approach from the beginning. Right now, we've got interveners and advocates, and we've got continuing education by the Post Board and others that teach us how to deal on the street with domestic abuse, all sorts of programs, but statewide, if we could somehow coordinate that and just take it from a statewide approach right away, it seems to make more sense than starting out in the metro and then trying to take it out to different areas.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish. And I understand what you're saying. I think the reason why we're starting in St. Paul, as mentioned, and I'll have Judge Klass respond to this too, but we do have a critical mass in St. Paul right now based on the information we have from the audit. Plus, I don't think it can be discounted, the personalities and individuals that we have involved that are really very dedicated to this. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it of people dedicated to ensuring that we have the best practices pulled together. That said, I completely understand what you're saying, that there are some differences in terms of how we respond in St. Paul or different judicial districts or different counties that will be taken into account when we move forward on this. There's no question about that.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair,
Judge,
Mary Louise Kloss, Representative Cornish, I think the reason that it's why St. Paul and why now is because of this critical mass, and because I've been, as a retired judge, I've been sitting in outstate Minnesota, which was a revelation to me since I'd been in Ramsey County with blinders on for so long. And in order for us to get to this critical point here in St. Paul, it took several years of getting agreement by the sheriff, by the county attorney, the sheriff, the chief of police, the city attorney, all of the players. Let me tell you, my experience in greater Minnesota sitting in court is that it takes a lot of work to get to that, and some places aren't there yet. So if we can develop a blueprint that we can take to a place which still has people looking at things from their own perspective, which is understandable, they can take it and work it and adapt it and maybe get to the point where St. Paul is now. But it would be helped by that blueprint.
Representative Cornish.
Just a quick point. That's my problem. I really don't like it being developed in St. Paul and then taken it out. I live in Mankato. We've got a totally different population with MSU down there, different ethnic groups. I go into the Cato shelter, and they're all non-English speakers in there, talking language that they can't even understand amongst themselves. And so rather than develop in St. Paul and then come out and find, oh, we should have done it this way, if you could bring people in from the different areas to begin with while you're developing it, rather than be surprised later, that's all.
Shelley Klein, Representative Cornish. Again, part of the budget for the bill is to do exactly what you're concerned about. And I do want to say, as someone, again, that has been in a Battered Women's Program in St. Paul, I have had Battered Women's Programs actually say to me, could you please come up with a model to have the relationships you have right now in St. Paul? And it's made me very proud. But absolutely, we have to have the voices of each one of those communities to make it work. And again, that's a big part of the budget.
Members, we have four more now who have questions. So just mindful of the time. If we have to, we'll take the bill up again on Tuesday, but I'd like to get through with it if possible. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was kind of my question. I understand the need. I understand what each of you said. And the blueprint word helped me a lot more than the framework word did. But I'm still not sure what $500,000 is going to be used for.
Representative Lodge.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, a budget has been developed working with all members of this group, all the players in this, to determine exactly what is needed. And that's probably a question that can be better answered by those who have developed the budget, so perhaps I'd leave it to them.
Are we talking...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, are we talking forms? Are we talking services provided? Are we talking... evaluation at the end? Are we talking all those things? Who's going to spend the $500,000? And is the $500,000 used to develop what you're taking out, or the discussions that take place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if it's all right, I think Ms. Klein might be
able to answer that. Do you have a quick answer to that? We could...
Yes, I do. The budget is to develop the blueprint and the materials and the tools and the education process to bring this throughout the state. That's in the budget. The budget is for the national experts to write this up in a way that it can be usable by everybody, and then to have a conference with stipends to make sure everybody can attend that conference and actually give people the tools to make this work. So, yes, that is in the budget.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, could you give a copy of the budget to share with us, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes. And number two, I would also add that the greatest value added of this bill is not just the $500,000. It's the individuals and personalities who are going to be brought together. I imagine that the value added is far, far in excess of this in terms of what individual agencies and volunteers are going to be doing with their time, with this just as leveraging that those volunteers to do it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, have you evaluated the way that the various judicial districts or cities across the state are dealing with it now, and are you confident that there's no program that could be used as a model already?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I think it might be best suited because that does involve some aspects of what I think the audit looked at. Perhaps I could ask one of the other testifiers.
Maybe what we could do with these questions, I'm thinking that we'll continue on a little bit after 9:30 here, but we're getting these questions down, and maybe we'll take this up again Tuesday if we need be. Do you have a quick response, Judge Klaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I'm very familiar with the fact that the domestic violence safety and accountability audit has occurred in about 50 cities around the United States and some in other countries. I am also aware that nowhere, in no other city, has there been this kind of stepping back and looking at integrating into the fabric of what occurs an appropriate response. These audits occur with federal money. That's how St. Paul got it. We made a request. The collaborative of St. Paul Intervention, St. Paul Police, and Isaiah together made a request to the Federal Violence Against Women Office. They turned us down at first, we went again, and we got some money. Every city should do this, but not every city is going to do it because it takes all of this collaboration and getting the signing on the dotted line of all the agencies that are going to involve. And once the federal money in all these other 50 jurisdictions is spent, the federal money goes away. Who knows whether the recommendations continue to be implemented, are tweaked as circumstances change, or the whole thing goes away in 5 or 6 years. That's what we want to avoid. We want to take the energy that's present in St. Paul now, the enthusiasm for working together on this, and make something that people can use wherever, whenever, and if they want to. And I can assure you, if we get the money, St. Paul is going to weave it into the fabric of how we respond so that we're going to do the best job in the whole state of Minnesota of responding to domestic violence.
Representative Murphy.
Well spoken.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And I welcome being taught how you're going to do that all the way across the state. But I still don't know what that is, and so I think the budget will help.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really quick because the committee has really asked a lot of the same questions that I had, and Representative Murphy had exactly the same question, and I just want to add that 6 or 7 years ago, I participated in a domestic violence task force in Olmsted County that was doing exactly this. And I don't know what the status of that is right now, but this is not a new idea, and I have the same concerns about why it would be necessarily run out of St. Paul. But it's been a very good discussion, and I hope we'll continue that.
Okay, Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo that very response. We've had initiatives in my community as well. The question that I have that maybe Representative Leshy would consider doing is to start this thing and say it's going to be statewide and fear nothing until 2010 seems to be way too open. I would appreciate if we're going to include something like this that we would focus on the statewide component of it from the beginning, and that we would get reports back to the legislature, maybe in the form of appearing before this committee each year to tell us the progress and tell us what's happening statewide. I just think that kind of connection here, because if this is going to actually be a committee or a process that's going to create something that's going to be used statewide and we're going to look at. This is a big issue, and I think there's lots of other initiatives out there happening all over the state now. And if they could be plugged into you when they start, that kind of networking could be very valuable. I think just to hand this to St. Paul and then walk away and not hear another report for 3 or 4 years, I think is the wrong approach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Eastland. And just briefly to answer Representative Liebling's question first off, too, there is no other county in Minnesota that is doing this currently now based upon an audit. There have been other task forces and efforts around the state, but no one has done this based upon the results of an audit like St. Paul is doing right now. And I would say also, Representative Eastland, perhaps you're right, and perhaps this would be something on that could be followed up on more diligently. I can say also that as a member of this committee and as a person who, with my real job, I prosecute domestics and I'm involved with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, I would anticipate that I'd be available for Q&A at any time on that as well. Nonetheless, I think you're correct, and perhaps that could be addressed when it goes in the omnibus bill.
Representative Haas, you have the last question.
Thank you. I'll be very quick. My area, my region, St. Cloud, has a pretty good program, but they were in my office and testified and lobbied me in favor of this bill. So they're seeing something within it that is justifiable for the whole state.
Thank you, Representative Haas. Representative Lesh and Ms. Lacombe is going to try to synthesize the questions here, or at least some of the confusion I think may still exist. And so if you could clarify that in writing to the committee, we won't have to have you come back. But I think you understood some of the questions about duplication, those kinds of things. So if we just get that clarified in writing, your budget and everything else that you took down. So thank you all for your testimony. Representative Lesch, closing words, anything?
No other closing words, Mr. Chair, other than by way of explanation. This is because we have some great people working on this in St. Paul, and we think it's going to work really well based on that.
Okay, we will lay House File 1311 on the table for possible. We'll lay the spillover for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, members, for your patience. This meeting's adjourned.